Good evening and welcome to this program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Angie Coiro. It is my pleasure to introduce Ruth Reichel, author of Delicious. Ruth began her culinary career as chef and co-owner of the Swallow Restaurant in Berkeley, where she played an important role in the culinary revolution of the 1970s. She began her food writing career with her cookbook, A Feastiary, and quickly moved on to become the food writer and editor for the Los Angeles Times. She became known for her adventurous spirit and her brazen honesty. Ruth returned to her native New York City as restaurant critic for the New York Times, then spent 10 years as editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Ruth has won 6 James Beard Awards and received critical acclaim for her best-selling memoirs, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, and Garlic and Sapphires. She's editor of the Modern Library Food Series. She hosted and executive produced Gourmet's Diary of a Foodie, which was seen on PBS. She also hosted the Food Network series Eating Out Loud and served as a judge for Bravo's TV series, Top Chef Masters. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ruth Reichel. This is something of a record. We take the questions from the audience, and I have never before been handled such a passel of questions before we even got started. So.
Wow. Just wait until we're done.
You've toured with books. You've done the book thing, but this is your first work of fiction. Does that evidence itself on the tour somehow? Is it different the way you face the crowds? Are you getting different response?
Yeah, but I think it's partly because I've just now written so many books that it's this sort of the cumulative thing of, you know, people have read the books and feel like they know me and are curious about, oh, what's she going to do when she's not writing about herself?
Well, it's funny you say that because I've taken the time to look over some of the interview questions that you have received, and you've gone out of your way to say, this is not autobiographical. These are memoirs. This is not a memoir. And at the same time, I see people saying, well, did you have a sister like that? And were you like Lulu? And it's funny to see people's urge to put you in there even when you say that's not you.
I know, and I think, you know, I probably asked for that by putting Billy into a food magazine. So, I mean, but, you know, she's not editing the magazine. She's 21, and she has a sister. I don't have a sister. And she's very shy, and I'm not at all shy. And but because she's at a food magazine, everybody is assuming that this is autobiographical in some way. It is absolutely not.
Well, she's also very gifted. She has a very educated palate, not educated, intuitive palate.
Yeah, well, she has, I had to train my palate. She was born with it. You know, I mean, she has this almost, I mean, I've given her a superpower, really. I mean, nobody can really just taste something and instantly pull all the flavors apart and know how to put it back together again. It's kind of, you know, there's a sort of fairy tale quality to that. I've always wished I could do that. And I thought, well, if I'm going to invent someone, I'm going to give her this special power.
Well, it's kind of a fairy tale essence to the whole book. She goes through so much. It's fast-paced. She goes through a lot of adventures. She meets a lot of interesting characters. You know, the situations change. She has a mystery to pursue. It almost has the sense of an invitation from you to come along and have some fun in this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is an entertainment. I mean, I love happy endings, and I love the kinds of books that you can just vanish into for a while. I mean, they have been a gift to me. Other people drink, take drugs, whatever. When I'm in trouble, I go into a book. And I mean, I can't imagine a life without novels. I can't imagine it. And so I thought, I want to write the kind of book that has given me this kind of pleasure. And I want to see if I can do it.
Were there any authors in your mind that you've read over time that you said, if I could be compared to X, I'd be perfectly happy?
No. I mean, it's its own thing. I mean, there are many writers I admire enormously, but I wouldn't dare to say, oh, you know, I want to be as good as, you know, X, George Eliot, Hilary Mantel, whatever. This is what it is.
This is your voice.
And it, yes.
Well, let's talk about your main character and the situation she finds herself in. And it's inherently funny, the situation that she ends up in. You were at Gourmet Magazine and it closed down. She is at a magazine that has closed down. But there's a ghost of that magazine going on. There's a tradition at that magazine to be there for their old readers. And even though the magazine is gone, the tradition goes on.
Yeah, well, I thought that it would be a great thing in a magazine if you had the delicious guarantee, which is your money back if the recipe doesn't work. And I mean, I always thought the readers would have loved it. And so the people who own, the Pickwicks who own this magazine, decide that even though the magazine is no longer there, people have their back issues, which certainly people have their back issues of Gourmet. And they feel like they need to keep somebody there to honor the delicious guarantee. So Billy is there alone in the Timbers mansion where the magazine is, honoring this antique now guarantee, and people are still making recipes. Many of them are 35 and 40 year old recipes and complaining about them.
But the mansion is full of mysteries, and she stumbles on one of those.
Yeah, she goes into the library, and I imagined, I mean, this is, I love libraries. And there's also, I mean, part of this book is an homage to libraries and librarians. And I imagined the most wonderful library I could possibly think of, golden light and long tables covered with books and big stuffed leather chairs and Tiffany lamps and Persian carpets and a kind of wonderful place to go and sit and read books. And Billy goes in there and discovers a hidden room that's behind the last shelf. When she pushes it aside, there's a hidden room. And in there are these letters. And she finds this group of letters that were written by a little girl during World War II to James Beard. And this pretty much came out of, I found a cache of ephemera from 1943. That was recipes from the Department of Agriculture on how to cook on rations and how to start a victory garden and how to join the Women's Land Army, which I had never heard of. And so I had all this World War II information rattling around in the back of my head. And I'm fascinated by World War II because it really is the only time that everybody in this country sat down at the same table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Roosevelt said, food is one of the fronts of the war. And it was your patriotic duty to, you know, use your rations wisely, to go out and forage, to eat as frugally as possible. And it didn't matter whether you were rich or poor, everybody was eating sort of together. And I love that notion. I mean, I love the notion of us as one nation. You know, everybody, the farmers are off at war, and so people are coming to help harvest the crops. I mean, everybody thought it was really important to feed the nation and to feed the soldiers. And so, you know, people came from all over the country to go out and help with the crops. And you know, at a time when we're losing farms in this country, you know, that understanding that food is really important and it ties the community together is something I really wanted to explore.
And you gave her an avuncular friend in James Beard.
Yeah. Well, I thought, I knew James not well, but a little. And I thought, certainly, if there had been anyone who would have written back to a desperate little girl saying, my father's in the war, my mother is working in an airplane plant, these recipes that I'm getting out of the cookbooks are terrible, help me, James Beard would have been the one to do it. And I could easily imagine him having a four-year correspondence with a little girl and becoming her adopted father, really. And I also, as a writer, loved the challenge of creating a character who's very important in the book, but who actually, we never hear from him. We only see James Beard through Lulu's eyes. She writes to him. And, I mean, because I would not have presumed to have written, have made up letters that he wrote. So it's just her writing to him. But you get, I think, a very clear sense of who he is and what's going on in his life from her letters.
And Billy goes looking for Lulu. Decides to see if she's still around, you know, if more correspondence can be found. And at this point, I'm always reluctant to say how much more we want to give away.
I don't think we should give too much more away. But, you know, it suddenly hits her after she has, you know, she now has a relationship with this person who lived 70 or 75 years ago. And it suddenly hits her that maybe she's alive. And so she goes on a quest to try and find out if she's alive. And of course, I started, you know, thinking, how easy is it to find someone? Today, we all leave enormous trails. But, I mean, if you try and find someone who the last time you hear from them is when they're a teenager in the 40s, so you do not know their work history. You don't know married name. All you know is her her maiden name. And I tried it with a few people. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to trace those people. And so she sets out to do it, and it's difficult.
You know, it's interesting because it's a book that would appeal to many ages, a good portion of whom can't fathom how you can't just look somebody up on Google, and how there really can be no digital footprints.
Right. And, you know, not only can you not fathom that, I mean, one of the things that's so, even, you know, to me, an amazing thing to try and imagine is, you know, today people go off to war, but they have their phone, their cell phones, they have Skype, they have Internet, they come home on vacation. These men went to war and they were gone for 4 years. They did not come back. You didn't hear from them. There was no internet. There were no cell phones. And even the mail was heavily censored. And often, you know, you wouldn't know for months whether your brother, husband, uncle was dead or alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, even, you know, after the battles, it took a long time to find out what had happened to people. And this nation of women, home literally alone, really fascinated me. And, you know, this idea of the women stepping up. And then I read a lot about, you know, what happened at the end of the war. And, you know, these women finding their own power and, you know, doing these remarkable jobs and then being told at the end of the war, go home, put on your apron, it's over.
Yeah, thanks.
Go back. Go. thanks. And, you know, and I found online this general going into a factory and saying, and he shakes his finger, actually, and he says, you girls and women, you put down your tools and go home as you promised you would do. The boys are coming back. And listening to this guy, I get outraged.
And somewhere the zygote that would be Gloria Steinem was going, hmm.
Exactly.
So how is the process different for you as a writer? I mean, when you're writing a memoir, you may have to refer to your old notes that you kept at the time, but there's not a matter of reading up and seeing how things were. Was there any learning or any surprise for you in the process of writing a fiction that you had to educate yourself about?
Yeah, this was, you know, people had said to me, I mean, my editor said to me, your memoirs read like novels. You can write a novel easy. And she also said, you know, actually, when you wore those disguises, when you were at the New York Times and you literally made yourself into someone else to go out and be anonymous, you were living fiction. So you know what it is to inhabit another person's body. So this is going to be a piece of cake for you. Well, guess what? It was not. Writing for me, I mean, as someone who's been a daily journalist for such a long time, you pretty much, you know what the story is, and once you figure out your angle, and for me it's usually getting in the shower and figuring out what my first line is, and then you just go and you write it. This, I didn't know that I needed to know so much that my readers didn't know. So I essentially wrote an entire book that was just backstory. I mean, I didn't know that I was going to throw this out. But when I was done with it, I realized that I had written all the things that I needed to know, but not necessarily what my readers needed to know. But that now that I knew the characters, I could then write the novel. It was a real revelation that I needed to know everything that when I started with memoir, I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I really needed to write down, you know, where everybody came from. I mean, it doesn't matter how minor a character it is in a book. You really need to know who they are, where they came from, you know, what they're going home to. There was a process. There was about a year when I literally was just writing, learning the characters. And then once I knew them, the surprise for me was I thought I could manipulate them, but they manipulated me. They surprised me over and over and over again. I mean, I thought that I knew what they were going to do.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, one example is there's the woman who runs the test kitchen at Delicious Magazine is Maggie, and she's a really mean person. And I kept trying to soften her. I didn't want her to be so mean, and she wouldn't have it. I mean, she just she just would not allow me to make her nicer. And Sammy is a character who got more and more eccentric as time went on. I really fell in love with him. I mean, he's wonderful, and he was going to be a minor character, and he insisted on being a bigger person and being much more eccentric. His language got completely flowery in a way that I had not imagined it would. And I kind of reveled in letting these characters go off and be themselves. But it really was at a certain point this notion of I would go into my studio and think, what's going to happen to Billy today?
What about when it's signed, sealed, delivered, the book is out, people are buying it, they're all talking about it? Do you look back and say, I could have done this with that character. I could have done that. I mean, what are the second thoughts, the closing thoughts when that's behind you?
I don't have any thoughts of, oh, I could have done X with the character. But I'm now find myself, I miss them. You know, I mean, I had all this time with them. And now I still find myself wondering, you know, I mean, what is Sammy doing now? I mean, what happened? What happens to Billy now? You know, I mean, her life is going on, and I don't know what's happening in her life now.
I hear a sequel.
Well, I hadn't thought about doing a sequel, but my Australian publisher keeps saying, you know, aren't you going to write a sequel? Aren't you going to write a sequel? I'm working on another novel right now that is not a sequel, but, you know, if maybe after this I will. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, another brick of questions has just come in. So
okay.
We're going to go into some of these. One of our guests wants to know, who are your favorite writers, whether they be fiction writers or foodie writers?
I have so many. I mean, I really reading is, I'm always in a book. I would say right now the contemporary writer I most admire at the moment is George Saunders, who his 10th of December is just a remarkable book. It's modest, it's kind, it's unique and imaginative, and I actually sometimes find myself on the subway looking at someone across the aisle thinking, oh, I wonder if he's like that guy in one of the stories. He's wonderful. I have recently rediscovered George Eliot and am completely loving her. Like everybody else, I love Jane Austen. Hilary Mantel just gives me endless pleasure. Jhumpa Lahiri's new book, I love. I really like Meg Wolitzer.
I'm amazed you have time to read this much. Frankly, I really am.
Well, I listen to books as well as, I usually have a book I'm reading and a book I'm listening to. I listen while I'm walking, while I'm driving, on the subway, while I'm cooking. I get a lot of extra time just listening to books.
I like this question. When you were at Gourmet Magazine, this audience member read that you banned using words such as sinful, yummy, and divine to describe food. Now that you're writing fiction, did you change the rules for word choice?
No, I did not. I still think you should be able to do better than yummy. Food should never be considered sinful. And we had a family story. When my brother was very young, he was taken to a very fancy restaurant. And at the end of it, the waiter, who was, you know, wearing a tuxedo, looked at him and said, "Sir, how was dinner?" And Bob looked up and said, "Oh, it was divine." And the waiter looked out at him and said, "Sir, food is never divine." And food is earthly. It is not divine.
You mentioned the whole deal of your wearing costumes so that you were disguises, so that you could, you know, go undercover and get an honest view of the restaurant. I think whenever people talk about you, that's one of the first things that ever comes up. What is it about that seizes people's imagining? You've done so much, and one of the first things people will mention is, she used to wear disguises.
I think one of the things is that up until that point, there was this notion that the critics were on the side of the restaurants, and that somehow they were aligned against the ordinary eaters. And there's something about that effort to go out and really tell readers what was going to happen to them, as opposed to going out and having the red carpet rolled out. And there's a sort of creepy, yeah, 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 I got this great meal because I'm so wonderful, I'm the restaurant critic. And I think there's something just very appealing about the democratization of the restaurant experience and about understanding that it's not just about the cooking, that going to restaurants is about having an experience. And part of that experience involves the food, but that it's much more than that. And that if you're really going to accurately describe what that experience is, you have to be anonymous as a critic. I think the other thing is that I think we all kind of love the notion of being given permission to become actors for a little while, to turn into someone else. For me, you know, I would put on these disguises and, you know, inside you're still you. So, and you'd look in the mirror and you'd think, oh, isn't that funny? You know, look what I look like. But when you go out dressed as this other person and people respond to you as if you are this person, you then, in a very real sense, turn into that person. And I think that's a fascinating idea to people. And I think the notion that we are in some way in control of how we present ourselves to the world is something that fascinates people.
Well, there's that fascinating thing you did in 1994 where you presented virtually a split-screen experience of a restaurant, first when you weren't recognized and then when you were recognized. And to say the least, the restaurateur was not happy with you that you had done that.
He was very unhappy, and I was terrified. I mean, this was a very powerful restaurant, and it was at the New York Times, and it happened to have been the chairman of the New York Times' favorite restaurant. For me to go out and say, yeah, you get a great meal there, but, Ordinary Joe really does not. My editors were terrified that I was sort of taking this on. And I knew if I'd made one mistake in this review, I was done forever. But I felt it was really important because in the food world, everybody knew that this restaurant, which was open to the public, was in essence a private club. And when I was at the restaurant critic of the Los Angeles Times, and I would go to New York and people would say, well, why don't we go to Le Cirque? And my response would be, well, no, I'm not known there. So, and people instantly understood, oh, you had to be known there. And the interesting thing about that review was that I later learned that the owner was truly horrified. I mean, he thought of himself as, I mean, he was a self-made man, and had worked his way up and owned the, fanciest restaurant in New York. And he was ashamed when he read that he was treating people like that, and made a serious effort to change that. And, today, if you go to Le Cirque, that will not happen to you. I mean, they really bend over backwards to be wonderful to everyone.
Well, what's the standard these days for a food critic? Known, unknown?
It's so much harder to be anonymous today in this time of cell phones. Everybody's picture gets taken. I think everybody makes an effort to be anonymous, but it's, once they've got a picture of you, then you have to change your disguise. And, if you have to change your disguise every day, it's really hard.
Well, one of our audience members wants to know how you'd characterize the other differences, the style and approach to food criticizing today, food reviews.
I'm not sure I understand the question, but there are many ways of writing criticism, and the most common one is just to do it as Consumer Reports. I am going to tell my audience how to spend their money. I've always thought those were pretty boring to read. When I was being a restaurant critic, I mean, I think that good criticism, whether it's of a restaurant or a film or a play or a work of art, is you give your audience a better way to appreciate the experience that they're going to have. You give them tools to experience this in a richer way. You give them history. You bring something new to it. So, I mean, to me, really good criticism when you go to, you know, to that museum or read that book, you have a richer experience because of what you've read. And that's what I was really trying to do.
What about the dawn of Yelp and Amazon reviews and all these other, you know, areas where people can go and discuss, I'm not a food critic, but here's what I experienced.
Okay, well, that's, you know, that's consumer reporting, and it's perfectly valid, and I think it's done two important things. One is it has made the professionals, it has put the onus on them to be better than anybody you can read on Yelp. And I think we now have probably the best critics working today that we've ever had, just because they have to be so much better than, you know, the bloggers, the Yelpers, etc. But even more importantly, it has made a more educated public, because I think today people have to bring their own intelligence to the reviews that they read. I mean, when you read all these online things, you have to read them with a certain amount of skepticism, and you have to decide for yourself. You know, the critic in X paper says this is good, the critic in the magazine says it's terrible. I go online and, you know, I read all these different opinions. Let me make up my own mind. And that's a good thing. We shouldn't have, you know, one voice. I mean, in the days of Craig Claiborne at the New York Times, I mean, there was one really loud voice who could make or break a restaurant, or, and that shouldn't happen.
One of the other things that's changed for people is their access to the ability to cook well. I mean, we get the Food Channel, the Food Network, the Cooking Channel, and you've had experience with those. You've actually been on these. And what do you think the presentation of these things, is it realistic for a person to take away ideas for themselves? Is it showmanship? What's your experience?
I would say two things about this. I mean, one, home cooks shouldn't think that they need to be chefs. And so, you know, one of the things that they do is frighten people. And I think, and the media has done that too. And, you know, all these chef cookbooks, you know, this notion that you're going to present a masterpiece to your family every night and that somehow you're a failure if you're not doing that is wrong. I mean, you know, really, cooking is man's natural activity. You know, we are cooking animals. We cook, they don't, and it's pretty simple and fun to cook. And we need to get that message out. That said, even though a lot of food television is remarkably stupid, it is. It has made a generation of kids who have grown up watching food television are passionate cooks because they have watched this stuff on TV and they like to cook, they're interested in cooking, they think cooking is a reasonable activity. It is food television that has made cooking, it has brought food into part of popular culture. You know, when I started writing about food, there was a tiny group of people who cared about food. And now, you know, food, restaurants, cooking, food television, reading about food, it has become, you know, as much a part of popular culture as books and movies and music. And that's a great thing. And that is because of food TV.
I wonder, too, if it teaches us as viewers something about our own place as food consumers. I have always seen myself as someone, a $400 meal is wasted on me. My sense of taste is not that, you know, doesn't make that many differentiations. I'm not educated about wine. But I think because I've watched Chopped for about 2 years now, and I've listened to the judges, and I've experimented in my own kitchen, I think my palate has become more educated.
I'm sure it has. I'm sure it had. I mean, when you listen to smart people talking about food, and I, you know, because I'm a judge on Top Chef Masters, I like to think that when you listen to us deconstructing those dishes, you're getting a different idea of, you know, how to evaluate food. And, you know, I listen to some of my fellow judges with a kind of awe, with their ability to describe food and, You know, one of my fellow judges on Top Chef Masters is a chef, and he brings a very smart chef's perspective to, you know, why someone shouldn't have done this, should have substituted something else. I do think you probably do have a better palate, and you should go out and get that $400 meal.
I have available dates if anybody. When you watch those shows, you're a pragmatic person, feet on the ground, and a good sense of humor. Do you occasionally watch the overdrawn, you know, the thrum of the drums and the lights swirling and who will be the winner? Don't you kind of go, oh, come on?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, a lot of great food TV is kitsch. I mean, if you look at, you know, some of that those Japanese, those early, what are those shows called?
Iron Chef.
Iron
that's
Chef.
Right.
I mean, that's pure kitsch. It's hilarious fun.
It is. Yeah, and if you look at it in that sense, there you'll be happy. This is great. What advice would you offer a 13-year-old young woman in training, practicing to be a chef?
Cook a lot. Read cookbooks. Eat in as many different kinds of restaurants as you can. I mean, not expensive restaurants, but eat as many different kinds of ethnic cuisines as you can. Really, you know, try and stretch your palate and also ask people, if you're training yourself, get good cookbooks. There are lots of terrible cookbooks out there. I mean, one of the things we really learned at Gourmet was in the last couple of years, we did columns about cookbooks, and I said to my staff, I want you to test. We'll run, you know, two different cookbooks that are about to come out, and anybody on staff who wants to cook from them, I'll pay for the ingredients, and cook anything you want. And it was stunning to me how many cookbooks just didn't work. So I think it's very discouraging for any cook, and especially a young one, to cook from cookbooks that lead you astray. So make sure you're working with good tools.
What are the ingredients of a good cookbook? How do you screen for a good cookbook?
I think you need to ask people. You need to ask smart people. You know, is this a good cookbook? Should I cook from these recipes? I mean, there are some cookbooks that just never let you down. And there are some that, you know, half the recipes, you will not end up with a good result. So it's really, especially for young people, it's really important that you start with really good recipes.
I want to switch gears a little bit since someone brought up youth. We're going to go with that.
Okay.
When you started out in your journalism career, I found it intriguing that you were involved with New West magazine back in the 70s. And it's funny to watch the trajectory. I don't know, funny. It's interesting to watch the trajectory since then. New West magazine was an effort to be like the New Yorker. It was a sister publication to the New Yorker. And it ended up as one of the bargaining chips when Rupert Murdoch was trying to take over the New Yorker. And there you were, you know, working with New West magazine, and flash forward all these years and see what Rupert Murdoch has become, and New West became California magazine, then met its demise. And I just wonder, with that wonderful perspective of looking back over that trajectory, what your thoughts are.
You know, we were very lucky. Clay Felker started New West, and when Murdoch bought it, he didn't really care about New West. So we had this moment of being able to do really extraordinary things. And I will never forget being in the office. We ran the first piece about Jim Jones, the first one that said, this guy is not what he seems to be. And at that point, he owned San Francisco. I mean, he had so much political clout. And I remember Rosalie Wright was the editor of New West, and I remember being in the office one morning when she was getting this enormous pressure to not run this very negative piece about Jim Jones. And I just remember her picking up the phone and hearing her say over and over again, "You can pull your ads. I don't care. Rupert Murdoch has millions," and banging down the phone. And I thought, you know, she was so brave. But, you know, they ran this piece. And then, of course, well, the tragedy of that is that Phil Tracy, who wrote that piece, then felt incredibly guilty about what happened and about the Kool-Aid and all the people dying, you know, following Jim Jones and you know, on that tragic thing. But we, it was a magazine that because we had this kind of little pocket of time when nobody really cared about us and was where we did very experimental journalism. I mean, I wrote what are surely the weirdest restaurant reviews ever written anywhere. I mean, they were kind of my first foray into fiction. My restaurant reviews, no, I'm not kidding. My restaurant reviews were little short stories with the restaurants woven through them. But I wrote, science fiction. I wrote love stories. I wrote things that were set in the 17th century that were, westerns. They were completely odd little restaurant reviews, and you know, my editors just came with me. And the hard thing for me was that when I was recruited to go to the Los Angeles Times, I mean, I had no real journalism background, and my first review, I didn't know that I couldn't do this kind of thing in a newspaper. So my first review, I imagined going with Gloria Swanson to this restaurant. And I handed it in, and my editor said, you know, "Ruth, we have to talk." And I said, okay. And he said, "This is a newspaper." And I said, "Yeah, I know that." And he said, "You can't make things up." "You didn't go with Gloria Swanson. She's dead." And it was, you know, it was this moment for me of, oh, I have had this extraordinary license in, you know, this experiment, new journalism, and now I'm in old journalism. And I have to figure out a new way to do it. But you know, I do think that, I mean, to get back to the trajectory, I had that same kind of license at Gourmet where they basically said, do anything you want. And I took that and ran with it. And there is not a lot of, that kind of license doesn't exist much anymore. I feel like magazines have lost that that kind of freedom and that sense of you know, let's see what kind of surprise we can put into this. And I think it's like we've lost something important. You know, to me, great magazines don't give people what they know they want. They give people what they didn't know they wanted. I mean, a great magazine should have some sense of surprise. You should open it up and go, "Oh, how fascinating! What an interesting thing to read. I'd never thought I wanted to read that." But, and I think we've lost a lot of that in what's happening in magazines today. As advertisers become stronger and stronger, their voices become stronger and stronger.
What's a great magazine now?
Well, I still think The New Yorker is a great magazine, but I also think that there are independent magazines that are being done with passion, that have unique voices. I mean, in food, I'm thinking of Lucky Peach, Cherry Bomb, Fool, which is a wonderful magazine from Sweden, but that's written in English, Modern Farmer. Modern Farmer, published out of Hudson, New York. And it's for this new generation of young farmers. I mean, it's for sexy farmers.
Back to some audience questions. Are cookbooks going to face their demise now that people are getting recipes from the internet?
I think that absolutely not. People go to cookbooks and to the internet for very different things. I mean, for an if you come home with a bushel of peaches and you think, what do I want to cook tonight with, or what am I going to do with these peaches? You're very likely to go to the internet and, you know, put in peaches and look for ideas. But people read cookbooks for inspiration, and people take them to bed, and people read cookbooks like literature. They read them for stories. I think that there are more cookbooks than ever being published, and I think that they continue to sell very well. There's room for both.
Were you surprised that Gourmet Magazine didn't make it? Because it did have that element of being read for entertainment and, you know, having more content than just recipes.
I was stunned when the magazine folded. I mean, our circulation was at its highest ever. Our renewal rates were at their highest. So the magazine didn't fold because the audience didn't like it. It folded because we were in a recession, and the advertising we had luxury advertisers, and they went away. I mean, they stopped advertising, and everybody thought it would come back. And I think the whole world was kind of shocked that this magazine that, you know, had such devoted readership was folded.
In fact, you were on the road promoting a cookbook.
I was. I was on the road promoting the second big gourmet cookbook, and I was called to come home and told that the magazine was folded.
Has anything picked up that mantle to some effect?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that there's a mainstream magazine that has that same mix of great writing, great recipes, fabulous photography, and, you know, a real interest in investigative pieces, and, you know, a magazine that is trying to take a big bite of the world and sees food as not just recipes and restaurants, but also as culture and politics and agriculture.
Someone with a blue pen and very distinctive handwriting has a great mind for questions. I'm going to give you back-to-back two questions from the same person. One is, what your favorite family recipe is that was passed down from your parents or grandparents, and from apparently the same person, who are three people you'd like to have a meal with, living or deceased, and why?
As everyone knows, my mother was a truly terrible cook. But her greatest cooking triumph was corn on the cob. And my brother and I never eat an ear of corn when we don't think of my mother. And she did it right. She called the farmer down the road and told him to go out and pick the smallest, whitest ears that he had. And he always thought it was so strange because she really wanted the small ears, but they are the sweetest and the juiciest. She put a pot of water on to boil. She got in the car. She raced over there. She came back, and we shucked them, and we put them in the water for a minute just so they were hot enough to melt the butter. And you will never get a better ear of corn than that. And every time I eat a really fresh ear of corn, I thank my mother.
And three people living or dead?
Three people living or dead I would like to eat with. One would be the first Queen Elizabeth, who absolutely, I'm fascinated by her. Probably the most powerful woman that ever lived on Earth. And I would love to put her at the same table with Cleopatra. I think the conversation between the two of them would be really fascinating. I mean, reigning monarchs, very different, but both very powerful in very different ways, and both people who knew how to use the fact of being a woman to foster their politics, both very bright. I would love to have George Saunders at that same table and see what he did with it.
What would be on the menu?
What would be on the menu? That is really interesting because I would probably try and feed these two women from great antiquity flavors that they had never had before. So it would be, I would have to study it, but it would be, you know, probably very modern food. I mean, things that were not available in, you know, in Egypt, in old Egypt, or in Elizabethan England. So probably a lot of New World foods because, you know, neither of them probably would have had a tomato, for instance, would have had corn, would have had, you know, all of the things that came from this. They wouldn't have, either of them would never have tasted a chile or anything really spicy. So I would probably try and give them, you know, all of these New World foods. Chocolate would have been totally foreign to them. And it would be fascinating to just lay out this banquet of completely new foods. I mean, I'm sure that they, I mean, I think that they would be people who were open enough to new experience that they would be fascinated by it.
There might be a book in there.
Yeah.
Can you talk about any difference between East Coast and West Coast restaurants?
Totally different in that the East Coast looked to Europe for such a long time that the great restaurants on the East Coast, for the most part, still have a, you know, French, Italian, continental background. And restaurants on the West Coast looked to Asia. They started looking east a lot earlier. And we have, you know, the palate here was, you know, the ability to get Asian, Indian, et cetera, spices and vegetables here is much more ingrained. You know, just California, the ingredients here are so fantastic that you can cook simple better here than you can on the East Coast. People on the East Coast like things sweeter than people on the West Coast. I mean, desserts on the East Coast tend to be much sweeter in an interesting way. For restaurants, if you're talking about East Coast, especially New York, because New York has so many tourists from so many different parts of the world, it's easier to have really fancy restaurants because they can do three turns. You can get the Japanese customers who come in early, the American customers who come in around 8 o'clock, and the Spanish customers who come for dinner at 11. And it changes the economics of restaurants in a way that really you can see the difference. You have more really high end fancy restaurants on the East Coast.
We sometimes get criticized here on the West Coast that we don't do formal restauranting that well. We don't dress up enough. We don't take it seriously enough.
You do different kinds of restaurants. And, across America now, I mean, we are losing formality generally. Americans, most of us don't want to dress up to go out to eat, even in very fancy restaurants. So, you know, I mean, that's a criticism you had much more in the past. We've developed a new kind of American service that is just less formal. It just is.
Getting back to the journalist side of things, the having written, you were with the New York Times, you were with the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, I was trying to say. Did you have any thoughts with what happened with Jill Abramson this past week?
I do indeed. I have no inside information about what happened. I mean, I have called friends at the Times, and they're all being very circumspect about talking about it. But I don't know how good a manager Jill Abramson was, but, you know, the New York Times is not famous for its, you know, warm and fuzzy management style, generally. I thought she produced a wonderful paper. They won, you know, a lot of Pulitzers under her leadership. And she was the first woman to hold that job. And I don't like the fact that she was fired in the way that she was fired. I think it has a chilling effect on women everywhere, women in the newsroom, women reporters I know at papers around the country are outraged. And, you know, I have enormous respect for Dean Baquet, but I hate the fact that a woman was dismissed in a pretty humiliating fashion and the job was given to a man. I that's what I think.
What about your own experiences coming up through various newspapers as a woman? What did you experience that you think might have been different had you been a man?
I have to say, honestly, I never had that experience. But that said, you know, I came in to the LA Times and then the New York Times in a princess job. You know, I mean, being the restaurant critic, I mean, being any critic is, you know, you come in at this very high level. I didn't have to work my way up. I'm not sure I could have worked my way up. I mean, that's really the truth. I mean, it's interesting to me that since I left the New York Times, there has not been another woman critic. I mean, it's not that there wasn't. I mean, Mimi Sheraton was an extremely strong woman critic before me. But, you know, if you look at, you know, who the critics are, there are, you know, there hasn't been, you know, the strong, important jobs there. I mean, the ones that are, you know, people who can really make and break theater critics. I mean, when was the last time there was a strong woman's voice in as a theater critic at the New York Times? I personally never experienced anything, really. But as I said, I came in at the top and left before I, you know, had the opportunity to. I mean, my deal with the New York Times was that when I didn't want to be the restaurant critic anymore, I would become an editor because I had been an editor at the Los Angeles Times. But I left before I had the experience of what it was like to be a woman editor there. So I can't say.
If you wanted to get today the kind of jobs you wanted back at the time, I'm comparing this to reporters. Once upon a time, a reporter had to primarily focus on reporting. Now they need to be able to do, you know, digital editing. They may need to take a video camera with them. There's all this multitasking that I wonder, in your particular venue, to become a food critic, to become someone who writes about food, how different would your qualifications have to be now? What would you have to learn that you didn't have to know then?
I would have to learn to take good photographs, which I have had to learn myself for my own blog. And, you know, I mean, it's certainly true that everybody now has to multitask. And, working in any medium today is just so much harder. I mean, you're never not there. I mean, wherever you are in the world, you're shooting video, you're responding to readers, you're posting 4 or 5 times a day. The job is much, much harder today than it was when I was doing it.
It's time for our last question. We're at the end of this already. I thank whoever sent this one. This is funny. What foodie question just irritates the heck out of you and why?
Well, you know, I get asked at almost every lecture or whatever I do, what's your last meal? And I mean, the answer seems so obvious to me. It's, of course, it's an endless meal. Why wouldn't it be?
Maybe it's just me, but please think about dying is not a very polite question.
But it literally gets asked every time.
That's amazing. Well, I'm glad we spared you that one.
Yeah, thank you. I bet it's in that pile.
I wasn't going to let that be known. Did this the last time I hosted the Commonwealth Club, and I've done it again.
Pardon me while I go get the gavel.
Oh, a gavel.
This will be edited out for the radio audience. I want to thank you very much.
Well, I want
to
thank you.
It's been lovely to talk to you, Ruth Reichel. And I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Our thanks to Ruth Reichel, author of Delicious, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussions is adjourned.
Great questions.